Hello and welcome to our program, Memory Lane, brought to you by Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I'm Eric Chase, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Reminisce Magazine here on Owl Radio. Faithful Record Keepers. Long Search Pays Off with Bonus Information by Marilyn Isabel Belmore, Randolph, Vermont. The Historical Society in Providence, Rhode Island, had excellent resources for genealogical research when I worked there in 1988. I became adept at using census records, directories, and newspapers, as well as birth, marriage, and death indexes to find missing family links. But it took me nearly 30 years to find the birth certificate of my own paternal grandfather, Frederick Octave Belmore. When I started my research, I looked for the family in town directories for Warren, where the family lived when Frederick was born in 1892. There were no copies of that year's directory, and the 1891 and 1893 editions didn't help, because the family hadn't lived there long. I even looked at the records in the surrounding towns. I contacted St. Jean Baptiste Church, the French-speaking parish at the time, to see if it had Frederick's baptismal record. But neither St. Jean nor the other Catholic churches in Warren had records for him. Over the years, finding the record became less important because I had everyone else's birth certificates and had traced the family to France. I also learned that names were misspelled or that relatives went by other names. In 2014, I wrote St. Jean Baptiste Church again, asking for a search of boys born around Frederick's birthday, May 18, 1892. This time, they found a baptismal record for Joseph Octavium Fredericum Bellamare, the original spelling of the family's last name. The record also noted when he married and where his wife was born. Now I advise not giving up in the search for genealogy. The information may be right at your fingertips, as it was for me all those years. The following article is a response to the previous. Search by Date, by Peggy Clemens Lawrenson, an accredited genealogist. Discovering your family's religious connections may provide information on generations of ancestors and extended family members, and it will sharpen your skills as a researcher. Marilyn kept trying different angles to solve her research problem. Knowing where the family lived when Frederick was born, she searched town records on both sides of the known birth years, and even consulted a street directory to see if she could uncover more information. But city, county, and state records are often mandated years after churches have begun to record life events. Ultimately, the exact date on baptismal records gave Marilyn the information she needed. To find out what churches existed in the areas where your family lived, analyze the Family Search Wiki, familysearch.org. Researching both the county and the state, you can find the earliest dates that vital records such as court records, probate, and land records began in the area. Locate county histories that may give clues. Lastly, recall holiday traditions that were part of your family's faith. Shape-Changing Protector by Randall Hill, Bandon, Oregon. Buoyed by the international success of their Godzilla and Rodan films during the 1950s, Japan's Toho Studios unleashed a third major monster character in 1961's Mothra. The movie's slim plotline involves a research group investigating the irradiated infant island in the South Pacific. The outfit discovers a primitive culture that worships the deity Mothra, ministered to by twin-foot-tall cave-dwelling priestesses. When a group member kidnaps the sisters for exploitation as a Tokyo nightclub act, Mothra hatches from her egg and swims to Tokyo, where she slithers in larval form through the city, enacting mass destruction. Under attack, Mothra forms a defensive cocoon on Tokyo Tower, where she metamorphoses into a giant winged creature. She flies to rescue the twins and finally returns them safely to their island cave home. Mothra appears to have an overt moral dimension, wreaking havoc only when hapless humans pose a threat to those that she looks after. Neither fully butterfly nor moth, she has jaws instead of a proboscis. She demolishes buildings by virtue of her sheer size, shoots flames from all parts of her body, and flies at supersonic speeds, generating typhoon-force winds with her massive wings. Second only to Godzilla in the number of starring roles and joint appearances, Mothra showed up in more than a dozen films out of Toho Studios over the years. Mothra often appears in battle against testy reptilian foes, including Godzilla, though he is sometimes her ally. But unlike Godzilla, who dies in each film, Mothra is always reborn as an essential protector of those in need. Golden Age in Harlem Neighborhood. The 1920s were in swing as writers, artists, and musicians transformed the streets of New York City's Harlem neighborhood with a powerful mix of artistic, social, and political work. The cultural movement began with the Great Migration of African Americans from the rural South toward northern industrial hubs and their promise of jobs. In urban centers, particularly Harlem, creativity challenged prejudice, shaped an identity, and uplifted a new generation. Jazz was the sound of the Harlem Renaissance, and Duke Ellington was a familiar figure at its center. But poets and painters, Langston Hughes, Jacob Lawrence, caught its rhythms too. The Harlem movement faded, like so much in the U.S. with the Great Depression, but it marked a turning point for Black culture. On the next few pages are some of the many artists whose works still inspire. By Natalie Wysong. Zora Neale Hurston, 1891-1960. Black-owned publications in New York catered to writers who were finally free to express themselves. They responded with a richness of poetry, essays, and fiction about African-American life. Zora Neale Hurston was a native of the rural South, a folklorist and anthropologist. Her novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God, was about folk she knew. Overlooked for many years, Hurston's writing regained attention in the 1970s thanks to Alice Walker. Hurston followed in the footsteps of writers such as W.E.B. Du Bois and Jesse Redman Fawcett. Du Bois was a lifelong activist for equal treatment of blacks and founded the monthly magazine The Crisis in 1910. Fawcett, the magazine's editor, identified promising writers and wrote novels dealing with race, class, and identity. Langston Hughes, 1902-1967. If the literary movement had a center, it was Langston Hughes, who recorded key first-person accounts about the era. His poetry drew from black oral traditions and the rhythms of blues and jazz. In a poem he wrote just after graduating high school, The Negro Speaks of Rivers, Hughes traced African roots from the Mississippi River back to the Nile and the Euphrates. Hughes was shaped by time spent abroad, and his insistence on expressing a strong sense of identity affected others in the movement, such as Lorraine Hansberry. Her Broadway play about the trauma of racism borrowed a line from Hughes' poem, Harlem. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Paul Robeson, 1898-1976. When Shuffle Along opened in 1921, it upended ideas about blacks on Broadway. In the chorus of the landmark musical was Paul Robeson, who started moonlighting on stage while practicing law. Robeson went on to groundbreaking achievement in roles that defied damaging minstrel show stereotypes. Playing characters in interracial romances in Othello and Eugene O'Neill's All God's Chillin' Got Wings. Showcasing African-American talent from writing to production, Shuffle Along and other musicals reached a wide audience and had lasting influence. The international craze for the Charleston dance was kicked off by Running Wild, 1924, for example. Jacob Lawrence, 1917-2000. Against the colorful backdrop of black-run studios, clubs, and churches, Jacob Lawrence came of age, poised to further the intellectual and creative activity of the era. As a teen, he latched onto art as a means of expression, encouraged by sculptor Augusta Savage. He worked with and later married painter Gwendolyn Knight, another of Savage's students. His subject matter included meticulous research, and his series of paintings that depict the lives of famous historical figures, such as Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass, are among his most widely known. Aaron Douglass, 1899-1979. The architect of the movement to reconcile black culture and history with contemporary American life was artist Aaron Douglass. Douglass was a new high school art teacher in Kansas City, Missouri, when he felt drawn to the creative center of Harlem. He found work there, starting in the mailroom at The Crisis, and his collaborations with authors and essayists quickly gained attention for their dynamic African motifs. His subjects were two-dimensional silhouettes of generic men and women with a limited palette of circles and rays to show movement and draw focus. Some of Douglass's most famous works were the innovative and bold public murals that he painted for the Works Progress Administration's Federal Art Project. Douglass went back to teaching and later reflected that his proudest accomplishment was mentoring the next generation of artists. Augusta Savage, 1892-1962. Augusta Savage was larger than life, a champion to black artists who got a start in her Harlem studio. Savage was drawn to sculpture as a child, using the distinctive red clay soil of her native Florida to mold figures. After studying abroad on fellowships, she ran a school out of her studio, offering free art education. Much of her work did not survive. A commissioned piece for the 1939 New York World's Fair, a 16-foot sculpture with 12 singing figures, was destroyed after the fair. Savage worked mostly in plaster rather than the conventional and expensive bronze. One existing sculpture in the Smithsonian's collection is Gammon, a bust of a young boy, which is done in plaster and painted to look like bronze. Duke Ellington, 1899-1974. The Jazz Age permeated literature, visual art, theater, and dance, and no one better represented Harlem's golden era of creativity than composer and musician Edward Duke Ellington. Ellington infused his music with his love of ragtime and his diverse catalog of compositions, written to suit the styles of the performers at the Cotton Club, was challenging and complex. No two performances were alike. Reaching audiences through live shows and radio broadcasts, Ellington elevated jazz, the American original, to an aesthetic. Louis Armstrong, 1901-1971. Jazz arose out of the black American experience, with a heritage of work songs, spirituals, blues, ragtime, and African-style rhythms. Louis Armstrong was part of the evolution of jazz from his youth in New Orleans to Joe King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band in Chicago. Bandleader Fletcher Henderson invited him to New York to play with his orchestra in 1924. In his acclaimed performances, Armstrong transferred the focus from the ensemble to the soloist. Armstrong returned to Chicago after a year. He continued his rise, pushing the musical form in a way that influenced other musicians and ushering jazz into the mainstream through recordings with popular singers such as Bing Crosby. For the next 50 years, Armstrong's playing shaped performers across the musical spectrum, an influence still felt today. Bessie Smith, 1894-1937. Bessie Smith on stage was powerful and majestic, and her recordings sold millions of copies. Orphaned, Smith was raised by her sister and sang for money as a child. The Empress of the Blues sang about the kinds of troubles that most listeners knew well. Even when she was the highest-paid black performer of her day, her laments felt personal. She was criticized for being rough and bawdy, but songs like "Tain't Nobody's Business If I Do" seemed to represent her feelings about others' opinions. In a world where the power was held by others, Smith defined prejudice and segregation to make listeners understand that her life mattered too. Copycat Cartoonist by Robin Sagal, Choctaw, Oklahoma. Back in the 1970s, I went to a small Christian boarding school where my brother Mike, known as Mr. Blanche, taught. I worked for him, reading aloud in classes and grading papers. But my favorite job was doing the bulletin board displays. Mike loved Peanuts, and that sparked my imagination. I'd photocopy the comic strips, put them on the overhead projector, and trace them onto the bulletin board. It was an inexact science, but I got pretty good at recreating the characters. Snoopy was a favorite. My brother's students, especially the freshman boys, liked the cartoons and would ask to keep them when I was disassembling a display. During a tour of the boys' dorm, we discovered several boys had papered their walls with the cartoons I'd given them. I thought it was cool that I had this little fan club among the freshmen. That is the closest I ever came to being a sought-after artist. Treats of the Past. Vintage Lanterns Shed Light on Halloweens of Old by Will Ogden, Wooster, Ohio. When I was in my 20s, a friend who was an antiques dealer had two Halloween-themed papier-mâché lanterns in his shop. I couldn't stop admiring them. A week later, they came in the mail, safely packed with a note. It said, "Enjoy." While in college, I'd take them out at Halloween and admire them again. Eventually, I looked for lanterns at thrift shops and, much later, on eBay. It became my hobby, and the search was captivating. As an avid collector, I've done a lot of research on these lanterns. Papier-mâché pulp holiday items were originally made in Germany in the late 1800s. American companies started manufacturing pulp lanterns in the 20th century. One of the biggest producers was F.N. Burt Company, a box maker in Buffalo, New York. It molded and painted egg carton material and then inserted a tissue face inside each lantern. Dime stores sold the lanterns in the weeks before Halloween from the 1930s to the 1950s. Children used them to hold their candy while trick-or-treating. Some carried candles in them to guide them as they walked. I have a few lanterns with burned candle stubs in the bottom. I was born in October, so I've always been a huge fan of Halloween and vintage Halloween items. I collect only original, intact, and gently aged papier-mâché lanterns. They give me joy. I often think of the children who carried them long ago, and I imagine their delight at receiving a lantern from their parents. How many of these treasures do I own? I quit counting at 50. Big Fish in a Small Pond. Little Brother Fell for It, Hook, Line, and Sinker. By Bonnie Borima, Naples, Florida. This is a different kind of fish story, one that's really about the relationship between two brothers. The younger one, Butch, is easygoing and dedicated to whatever he does. Kenny, who's my husband, is 7 years older and has always been a joker. He loves to play tricks, especially on his little brother. For his 5th birthday, Butch got an aquarium. It was filled with aquarium ornaments and had lots of room for several small goldfish to swim. Every day after school, like clockwork, Butch fed the little guys. He loved those fish. This routine went on for some time, until Kenny had the bright idea of playing a prank on his little brother. One day, Kenny bought a large goldfish, about 6 inches, and used Butch's fish net to move all the little goldfish from the aquarium into a smaller bowl. He left the one big fish in the aquarium. It was a good thing that Butch was taking a particularly long time returning from school that day. Then, Kenny hid in his brother's closet and waited. The first thing Kenny heard after his brother got home was Butch yelling,
"Mom! Look!"
Their mom came in and was as flabbergasted as Butch at the surprise in the aquarium. Kenny listened to Butch trying to account for the mystery.
"Maybe I mixed the fish food and I discovered something. I could be rich."
Mom wondered where the other fish were, and Butch surmised that the big goldfish had eaten the little ones. Finally, Kenny couldn't contain himself. He came out of the closet laughing so hard tears were falling. The jig was up. As usual, Kenny got in trouble, but he was used to that. Cruising in the Ford. Parents put the brakes on borrowing the family car. By James Farkas, Northville, Michigan. One Sunday, the girl I was dating, her name escapes me, invited me to her house in Lincoln Park, Michigan. At age 17, I had my temporary license and had already suffered the humiliation of Dad driving us to a school dance. But now, he was asleep in front of the TV, and the car keys were in their usual spot in the kitchen. As I drove from Allen Park to her house, I put on the latest Detroit doo-wop so I'd look cool as I drove up. We cruised down Fort Street and went to the drive-in for a malt and skinny fries before I got nervous. At home, I faced the firing squad. My Lincoln Park sweetie didn't wait for me while I was grounded for 4 weeks, and she moved on to date someone who had a car. I'd saved $500, and Mom thought it was time Dad used his influence as a Ford employee to get me the best deal on a used car. That shopping day was one of the most important of my young life. We found a 1951 powder blue Ford Custom with baby moon hubcaps and bubble skirts. It even had air conditioning and a radio. After much dialogue, Dad and the salesman agreed on $800, with Dad putting in the extra for me. 2 weeks later, it was my turn to drive my friends on a Friday night. Joe, Norm, and I headed for Michigan Avenue in Dearborn, which was jammed with custom hot rods. With the windows down and moving at a crawl, we tried our best to get the attention of the cute girls at the drive-ins. I wasn't watching the traffic in front of me, and with a loud thud, I hit the rear of a black 1950 Ford. There was no damage to the older couple's car, but my front end was smashed. They felt sorry for me, and luckily, the only expense was replacing my custom Pontiac grill. Dad thought it was a lesson learned, and all Mom could do was laugh. From then on, I kept my eyes on the road, no matter how cute the girls were. Texas native sticks close to home. Flat top rolled off the line when he graduated. By Melvin Siebold, Floresville, Texas. Needing something to do when I retired in 1999, I was inspired by a friend's hobby, restoring classic cars. In 2008, I finally found the right project. The car was still with its original owner and had 74,000 miles on it. Parked in an open garage for 34 years, it was covered in a layer of dust and had 4 flat tires, a dented rear door, and a cracked side window. There was no ignition key. On the plus side, Blue, as I called the car, had only a little surface rust. It had power seats, windows, brakes, and steering, along with a power antenna and a Wonder Bar radio. Under the hood was a big 401 cubic inch V8 and automatic transmission. By mid-2009, Blue was back in showroom condition. I've entered it in many parades and car shows and brought home numerous trophies and awards. I learned that the car was built in Arlington, Texas, and sold new from a dealership near there. It eventually was retired to the garage where I found it near Floresville. You could consider it a Texas native. Blue's model year is the same year I graduated from high school. It was the last year of the big fins. Car buffs call this four-door hardtop style a flat top. just like the hairstyle I wore in high school. Many friendly hands make light work. Accident at Harvest Time brought farm neighbors together. By Lloyd Richards, Mooresville, North Carolina. Helping neighbors was something everyone did when I was growing up on a farm near Meriden, Kansas, in the 40s and 50s. Near the end of one wheat season, our neighbor Raymond had a terrible accident. My dad and I kept an eye on his crop, and one day we decided it was ready and started up our 1941 Farmall H tractor and pull-type combine and Alice Calmer's All Crop 66. We knew that when the neighbors saw us harvesting Raymond's field, they would come out and help if they could. Sure enough, shortly after we started cutting, people began showing up with their equipment. More combines, balers, trucks and tractors with plows and discs. The wheat field was about 25 acres, pretty big for eastern Kansas at the time. The combines were small. Ours cut a 5.5-foot swath. The ones today can cut a swath 60 feet wide. A combine that big couldn't even have turned around in the field. By mid-afternoon, the farmers' wives, mothers, and other family members began to arrive, bringing fried chicken, pies, and more for the army of workers. At the end of the day, Raymond's wheat had been harvested and taken to the elevator. The straw was cut, baled, and stored, and the field was plowed and reworked. Raymond was able to come out of the house and watched all the activity from his yard. He knew that everyone had their own farms to take care of and what it meant that his neighbors had spent their day helping. Farmers like to brag a little about how much better their tractors are than somebody else's. It's all in fun, but most of the talk that day was about how fast Raymond's crop went from a field of wheat to one ready for the next crop. Several years ago, I moved to an over 55 community where we still try to help one another. The appreciation for neighbors helping neighbors has stayed with me my entire life. You've been listening to Memory Lane on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Eric Chase saying goodbye from Owl Radio.